everyone, and welcome to Better Done Than Perfect, a podcast for SaaS founders and product people. Today, our awesome guest is John Kotovsky, founder and CEO of Buyersun Inc., and we're going to talk about SaaS product monetization, everything about pricing and what you can do to leverage it for business growth. This show is brought to you by UserList, an email automation platform for SaaS companies. It matches the complexity of your customer data, including many-to-many relationships between users and companies. Book your demo call today at userlist.com. Hey, John.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for having me.
We're so excited to learn from you today. Before we get started, tell us about yourself, your background story, and what you do at Buyersun.
Yeah, for sure. So my name is John Kotovsky. I'm a product leader turned entrepreneur. I've been in the product industry or the tech industry for the last 20 years. I spent the last 10 years at software scale-ups leading different product teams. The last three companies included Chango, which was an ad tech company acquired by Rubicon Project, Tulip Retail, which provided mobility solutions for retailers like Chanel, Michael Kors, and Kate Spade. And my last company was Format, a bootstrapped company that essentially was a website builder for artists and creative people. And what I learned through all that experience, Jane, is that product teams have become increasingly better and better at creating value for customers. But truthfully, they still are really bad at monetization, which is the process of deriving revenue from their products. They usually leave it up to sales and marketing, and it's usually an afterthought. At Format, we didn't have a sales team. So when I joined as a head of product, I not only had to build the products, but I also had to figure out how to grow revenue. And that's where I learned a lot about monetization. It was a success. We grew the company and we sold it in November. Since November of 2021, I've decided to go off on my own. And that's how Buyersun Inc. was born. And this is where we've taken these lessons that we learned at Format, and we now help other SaaS companies with product monetization.
So other SaaS companies come to you for pricing advice. What is that point in their growth trajectory when they realize, oh, we can't do that our own, we need a pricing consultant?
Yeah, so typically what we see with different SaaS companies is they spend a lot of energy on customer acquisition and retention. But if you think about revenue, there's really three components. Obviously, acquisition and retention are two very important ones. But the third component is monetization. So companies that usually struggle with growing average revenue per account or ARPU, average revenue per account, that see very little expansion revenue, where again, like they're getting accounts, they're getting customers, but the average revenue stays flat, or potentially, again, they're struggling with just understanding how pricing increases or anything related to pricing will increase or affect their revenue. That's when we usually come in and we do consultations. We do it on sprint basis. So our focus is really on customer research, really understanding the customers, their developing buyer personas, understanding their future preferences, and then working with product teams to implement changes based on those findings.
I'm curious, when you come in, what are the most common problems that you find and then you can fix using your consulting efforts?
Yeah, so the first one is really lack of customer insights. So when it comes to monetization, which to me is more than just pricing and packaging, pricing and packaging is a big component of it, but ultimately it's the whole customer journey. So one of the big challenges is that there's just not enough research or an expertise about customers. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is pricing and packaging is one of those things that tends to be neglected, and there's no clear owners of who actually owns it. So those are sort of like the two most common pain points is lack of ownership, lack of expertise, and lack of time to actually devote to doing proper research.
I would love to add another one is that the experiments are not that easy to run because the implementation of new pricing or pricing change, it's not always as easy as changing plans in Stripe. It sometimes means completely new onboarding flow or a rework of the UI that's related to billing or something. It's pretty intense on the resources. And SaaS companies are pretty tight on those resources.
Yes. And to be honest, pricing changes, especially increasing prices, can be pretty scary. A lot of companies fear and for good reasons, that it may actually have negative impact on revenue. It may tarnish their reputation. What we found is, and we went through this with Format, raising prices typically, obviously, you know, the more research you do, the better. But typically, when you change pricing, you want to make sure you're aligning the value that you're offering or your products is delivering to these customers. And look for signals where, again, either through research or even if you look at, take a look at something like your NPS survey. And if you see that customers are not complaining about pricing or they're saying, they're leaving comments like, this is really good value for the money. Or if you look at your exit surveys from customers that are churning, and if you don't see anybody complaining about pricing, that's another good signal that there's an opportunity to raise prices. So when you roll out pricing or pricing changes, obviously, you know, like it's good to experiment. Experiments are often hard to set up because it's not like you can show one set of prices to half the customers and show another set of prices to another set of customers. So it's not always easy to A/B test pricing changes. You can do it in a sort of still controlled fashion. For instance, you can roll out pricing for new customers while grandfathering old customers on old pricing and then giving them a year or even more before moving them to new pricing. You can always roll back pricing changes. It's not easy because of the complexity of billing systems. But if you go too high, you can also apply what I call smart discounts, where you give them some amount off at first and then before the full price kicks in.
We live in a pretty interesting time. There is obvious inflation around the world. Actually, as we're speaking, we're planning for a workshop next week about inflation and things like that. So that's a pretty hot topic, not just for your company, but also for some other guests here. You just published a killer article that outlines tactics that can help SaaS companies combat that inflation and what they can actually do. When, of course, we're going to link to that article in the show notes. Could you give us an overview of those tactics and what every SaaS company has in their arsenal to fight the situation and improve their growth numbers?
So the article is called SaaS Monetization, the Secret Weapon for Growth. It's published on productled.com. And especially as you mentioned, Jane, in the current economical situation where there's a lot of inflation, a lot of companies are trying to figure out how to grow despite all this inflation. And monetization is one of those levers that's usually untapped because, again, there's lack of ownership around monetization. It's not like, you know, again, it's one of those cross-functional disciplines that often lacks a clear owner. Now, the good thing about monetization is you can pull that lever and you can get additional growth with very little R&D investment. You can do it by leveraging your existing offering, your existing products. And the three tactics that I described are raising prices, adjusting your plans, and applying smart discounts. So let me just walk you quickly through all three of these.
Let's do it.
The first one is raising prices. So as I mentioned it before, raising prices can be scary. But even if you don't do a full-blown pricing study, you can look for signals where that indicate that your products are underpriced. Look through your NPS comments. Look through your cancellation survey. If your churn rate is pretty low, and by low, I mean under 1% per month, that's another a signal that there's room to raise prices, especially if you have a sticky product that's hard to, where the switching cost is pretty high. Now, when raising prices, it's best to align it with value and your what we call buyer personas. So again, once you sort of figure out who your customers are, how to split them into buyer personas that describe their attributes as well as their feature preferences, then you can start modeling this. And basically, what our advice is, you know, at the end of the day, you're still taking a risk when raising prices. But if you can model it, and if by increasing prices, the net effect is better than the loss in conversions and a churn rate, because those are inadvertently will go up or will go in the opposite direction that you want. That's the sweet spot. Now, obviously, there's a lot of studies you can run. A lot of companies don't have the money or resources to do it. But again, you can model it and take some educated guesses before raising prices. When you do raise prices, you have to make sure you communicate and reinforce the value to your customers to justify the raise of prices. Netflix does this all the time. I don't know if you're a Netflix subscriber, but they've been raising prices on me for the last 3 or 4 years. And every time they raise a price, they send you an email saying, hey, look at all the new shows we've added. Look at all the value we're delivering to you. So what you want to do is something similar where you communicate to your users and constantly reinforce the value that they're getting from the product. So when you do announce that difference in pricing, it softens the blow.
Let's box the topic of raising prices and the mechanics of it, and let's come back to it later in our conversation today, because it's a whole different story. It's not just about a value, but also who you raise, how you announce and stuff. So let's talk about this later. Let's do adjusting plans, the second tactic.
Yes. So most SaaS companies work with what we call good, better, best types of plans. So you have three plans. So what's in the article is an example from Format, where we had Basic, Pro, and Pro Plus, three different plans at three different price points. Basic was the entry point, and that had the least amount of features, just the core product offering. And as you moved up the plans, you got more and more features. So the key around adjusting pricing is our plans is to make sure that you've identify the features that people are willing to pay extra for. And ultimately, you want to pick price points that go along with that set of features. One thing we did at Format was we had three plans at one point, Basic, Pro, and Unlimited, which was $6, $12, and $25. And very few people picked the Unlimited plan. The delta, the difference between Pro and Unlimited was $13, and it was more than the price of Pro, which was $12. So, and there wasn't enough value for somebody to go with that plan. What we ended up doing is we ended up scrapping that plan, and we introduced a middle plan, or a plan called Pro Plus. At the end of the day, we ended up shifting new customers to the middle plan, which is priced at $18 versus $25. And we ended up raising ARPU from new customers by 25%. And it happened overnight. Literally, we released that plan. We bundled new features with that plan. And overnight, every new customer, the distribution of new customers has changed overnight, driving up ARPU by 25%. So that's an example of adjusting plans and worked for us at Format. The last tactic is smart discount strategy. Discounts can be a slippery slope. Once you start discounting, it can be dangerous because it's hard to get off. It's, you know, like you see a lot more conversions from customers. And again, like once they get the discount, they often ask for the same price. So it's a bit of a slippery slope. But what has what I've seen work well is what we call smart discounts. So smart discounts is where you incentivize somebody to sign up at a lower price point. So you create either a free or a discounted offering. For example, QuickBooks online accounting software does this very often, where they promote first 3 months at 50% off. So it lowers the barrier to entry. Instead of $22, it's $11. You get a chance to subscribe to that product, try it out for 3 months. They have my credit card or your credit card. And then it's sticky enough that when the full price kicks in, again, they're getting the full revenue. So they're getting $22, their original price for the entry plan. But because they lowered it to $11 with 50% off for the first 3 months, they increase their conversion rate because the sticker shock isn't as big as, again, the original price. So that's the third tactic. We applied that at Format as well. So Format, being a website builder, supported third-party domains. So you could buy a domain, a custom domain, attach it. And that was an add-on. And we priced it at $0 for the first year. So you get it for free if you subscribe to an annual plan. But after 1 year, we charge you $20. So it had a dual effect. One was that it created stickiness because nobody likes to deal with DNS settings. Once you set up your domain, moving it somewhere else is always a pain in the butt. The second thing it provided us with is after that 1 year, it created extra expansion revenue. It wasn't a huge amount of revenue, but a $20 per user every year once the full price kicked in.
We talk about raising prices all the time, but other situations when, well, you should be lowering prices, or when you can really make a mistake, when a business needs more customer headcount and spread versus, you know, quality of the customer and the revenue. They just care about the growth. What are those businesses that shouldn't be raising prices?
So that's a good question. Ultimately, you have to look at your acquisition costs. So ultimately in SaaS, as you know, LTV to CAC ratio, lifetime value of your customer to how much it costs to acquire a customer should be at least 3 to 1. And you can divide it by segments, and you can look at you know, if you have an enterprise segment versus entry-level self-serve segment, you can look at what does that ratio look like. And really, for the business, especially a good SaaS business to work well, you need to stay within those parameters. So if your CAC to LTV ratio is not good, again, like you have to take that into consideration when raising prices, because if you are raising prices, and again, like that, the cost of acquisition of higher or more customers who are willing to pay more goes way up, that may throw off that ratio. So like big piece of advice is pay close attention to LTV versus CAC. Again, the other one is you may want to go down market, or you want to apply or have a tier that is attracting entry-level customers, which again, and they tend to be very price sensitive. So if part of your strategy is to acquire a large number of customers, you may want to leave the price of the entry-level plan alone, or even discount it heavily to attract those customers, assuming that those customers will eventually convert to higher tier plans. So as an acquisition strategy and expanding or building out a customer base at a lower tier, be careful with raising prices for entry-level plans.
Yes. In our experience, for example, at UseList, we had an experiment a couple of years ago with a $9 entry plan. And that audience was the most sensitive when they had to upgrade. They were like, oh, I don't see value, goodbye, like kind of people. Yeah. And overall, the higher the price point, the better the audience you get most times. They're more patient, require less support very often. And also, if you struggle with activation, high price can help with that because they treat it as a more serious commitment, as counterintuitive as it sounds. Also, the perceived value of the product also looks nicer in their eyes. So there is win-wins all around.
There's lots of win-wins. Obviously, with higher pricing, you get more revenue, so you can actually devote more time to activation. You can have human-assisted activation, so you can get your customer experience team to get on the call with your customers and help with that activation. The lower the price point, especially if we're talking about, you know, $10 a month, the more automated, the less sort of human support you can provide them with. But it is a very price-sensitive segment.
You talked about CAC and LTV. This is great as soon as you know them specifically. But let's imagine a startup. How do they calculate their CAC? They are, for example, pumping money in creating content and doing SEO here, writing articles, doing other stuff, maybe occasional founder-led sales or something. Like completely untrackable. Are there any back of the napkin ways of figuring it out? Because per lead attribution is really far from being realistic.
I don't think I have a silver bullet for you, dear Jane.
I'd be surprised if you did, but still.
Yeah, when it comes to, especially where we operate as buyers, and we usually come in when there's established product market fit. So if you're just getting started and you're getting your first set of sales and your CAC is all over the place and it's not even clear if there's a product market fit, it's a little bit too early to get into this. This is more, again, like the companies that benefit the most from investing in product monetization research and related initiatives are the companies that are typically hitting 5 million in ARR, where there's clear product market fit, there's repeatable sales, and usually somewhere between 5 to 25 or 50 million revenue, there isn't enough justification to hire a pricing expert full time. So this is where we see our sweet spot, and this is where we see the biggest opportunity for companies to leverage monetization, because again, they're not big enough to have in-house expertise, and typically, the pricing and the whole monetization model was somewhat ad hoc and put together either by founders or by copying competition. So that's where we come in and really understand their customers, really through interviews and through surveys. We bring insights that help them tune in or hone in on what is the right way to price and sell their products to optimize the revenue.
I'm not going to ask the same question about LTV because it's obviously the similar answer to that. Speaking of the owner of pricing, I'm surprised that the product owner, head of product or product manager, depending on the scale of the company, aren't they the owner of the pricing problem?
So Jane, in terms of ownership of pricing, I truly believe, especially somebody who played head of product role for so many years, that product teams should own pricing and product monetization. And the reason why I strongly believe that that should be the case is because the product teams are the ones who are creating value through product. So when they build products, again, they need to deliver value to end users. And monetization is all about deriving revenue from that value. So they're the best position to understand the customers and the value that they're delivering. In reality, though, product teams are focused on building features, and monetization and pricing is almost like an afterthought. It's like, okay, now we're ready to launch this feature, or we're ready to launch this product. Here you go, marketing team, you know, go and promote it, or here you go, sales team, here's a one page on how to sell it. I've been at companies where pricing was left up to sales, where salespeople were making up their own pricing. That's probably the worst thing you can do, because they're not incentivized to maximize pricing. They're incentivized to close deals. I've been at companies where marketing has been in charge of it, but again, they don't really understand the product or the customers enough. They tend to put together really nice pricing pages, but again, it's not necessarily based on research. So I do believe product teams should own pricing and monetization. And in fact, it should be incorporated into roadmap planning and product strategy process. So before building something, you should really determine, how is this going to be monetized? Is this feature going to be released to everybody? Is this going into the premium plan to acquire more customers? Or is it going to be only available to our enterprise users? And here's the revenue we expect from building this feature. So I strongly believe product teams should own pricing and monetization. In reality, I haven't really seen that happen.
There are levers that are not specifically pricing, the level of pricing, but related to monetization. And one of them is when to ask for a credit card, and that affects the product dynamic like dramatically. And the another one is the length of the trial. I have an example. My product manager friend started as a product owner at an ad tech startup. And first thing she did was kill their enormous 3 months trial, because that was exactly almost like LTV. And they were delivering that all for free to the majority of the users. So that led to amazing results, obviously. What are your thoughts about credit card upfront? And we had many battles about this with my co-founder at all times.
Yeah, so when it comes to credit cards, ultimately, it's a balance between getting more users into the product versus getting their credit cards. Obviously, if there's a free trial, no credit card required, that's the least amount of friction. So you'll get the most trials or freemium users that way. If you ask credit card upfront and you say, you know, enter, you can cancel at any time. It's a free trial, 14 days, whatever. You're introducing a friction point, so there will be a drop-off at that point. Ultimately, it depends on how quickly you can get users to the aha moment. So that's a big part of it. So you want to demonstrate value from the product, but the other, you know, whether to ask for the credit card upfront, like Netflix. So when you sign up for Netflix, it's a 30-day trial for free, but you have to provide a credit card upfront. What we did at Format, my previous company, we had a 14-day trial, and only after 14 days, we asked you for a credit card. So ultimately, which one is better? I think that's something that can be A/B tested for sure. So unlike, you know, raising prices, you can sort of experiment with different cohorts to see, you know, if you ask for a credit card versus don't, how do they convert at the end of the 14 days? But ultimately, if you are doing a free trial, you want to make sure you're using it properly. And by saying using it properly, I mean, you use that period of the free trial to get them to demonstrate value and help them develop habits where they start using the product. So by the time you do ask for that credit card or you make that payment, again, they feel convinced it's worth paying for. So again, like you ask whether it's asked for a credit card upfront or not, that can be experimented with, but ultimately it's about the value. And ultimately, you know, like the other factor is, you know, like how much of a commitment are you asking for? Are you asking for a monthly commitment? So are you doing month to month billing, or are you asking for a yearly payment upfront? with month to month, obviously the churn is much higher. With yearly, you know, the churn rate is lower because you only have one chance per year as a user to really cancel your subscription. So the churn is much, much lower. You can artificially almost push people towards annual plans if you provide steep enough discounts. So if you charge, you know, $20 a month for a monthly plan, but if you charge $120 for per year, you basically are giving them 50% discount. So you can definitely get more people on annual plans that way. But ultimately, you know, like, is your product going to be consistently delivering value over those 12 months? That's the question. Will they be using it? So it also comes back to frequency. What is their natural frequency? Do they use it every day? Do they use it every week? Is it just one-off or once a year kind of thing?
The common industry, maybe not an official benchmark, but you can expect 3x to 4x more trials if you remove the credit card requirement. But the question is, do you want those people in your pipeline? Like with Useless in old days, we had a lot of discussions whether we should remove the credit card requirement. And we kept arguing until we grew and understood that we are also asking for a lot of work as a commitment. So credit card doesn't hurt. Actually, it does improve the conversion. Well, it wasn't a quantitative result that we've learned that, but definitely on the customer research level, we understood that very clearly.
That's a good point. If you expect, or if you need somebody to do a lot of work up front, you know, asking for a credit card definitely sort of it increases that commitment, right? So it's like, okay, I put in my credit card, now I'm committed, even though I can cancel before you hit my credit card, I feel more committed. The quality of trials will definitely go up. The other consideration is if, depending on your support structure, if you do have a team supporting, then you have to consider the cost of support. Because if you're getting a lot of trials that are poor quality trials, that are, again, if you don't ask for a credit card upfront, then you're spreading your support team a lot thinner, or you have to hire more. So then you have to consider your support costs. Again, if you ask for a credit card upfront, higher quality trials, less trials, but again, your support team can be a little bit more effective in that case.
Yes, definitely. Forgot to mention that, but it's crucial for any pricing change that you do. How many customers has you served? Not always good headcount is better for your company because you'll have to invest more in support at the same time. You say that the key to success at Buyerson is research. That's how you approach pricing for your clients. Can you give us a sneak peek behind the curtains? What kind of research is happening there?
Yeah, for sure. So the first thing we do with research is really to understand how to develop, we really focus on buyer personas. And what I mean by buyer personas is the first thing we want to do is understand what are the quantifiable attributes that we can use to segment the customers. So I'll give you a couple of examples. One of them, I'll just make one up, Figma. You know, like Figma has a lot of customers. Some of them are free, some of them are paid, but they do have different tiers. And one of the attributes they could be using is how big is the design team? So if it's a solo, that's one buyer persona. If it's a designer working on a team of five, that's another one. And once you start understanding how to segment your customers based on those attributes, you can then it's a matter of really understanding what are their biggest pain points. So at Buyerson, one of the first things we do is we interview internal stakeholders and get their perspective on segmentation. We typically run surveys to confirm what the internal stakeholders think is the right segmentation with their actual customers. Once we do that, then we set up interviews to actually talk to those customers to really understand what are their pain points and what do they value about the product. And this is how we begin developing buyer personas. Once we have those buyer personas, that's when we start asking the pricing related questions. This is where we start asking what features are most important to you, least important to you, et cetera, to understand how to package the product. And lastly, we ask willingness to pay questions. So really to assess what price point is a good price point for that set of features for the product that delivers the value to that buyer persona. So that's the secret sauce, so it's not really secret sauce, but this is our approach, is to really build out the buyer personas with attributes, feature preferences, and willingness to pay attributes.
You know, we've all read research books. We know that willingness to pay question and answer does not equal willingness to pay in real life because it's a very stretchy matter. So any special tricks on how you ask those questions to ensure that you get close to truth results somehow?
To be honest, Jane, I think it's this is sort of like the case where you have to, you can ask questions, but ultimately, you know, like you'll never get the perfect answer. You know, like you get the answer once you start charging clients and see if they actually pay the price that you have for your product. There are sort of known studies or surveys that you can use. The most popular one is called Van Westendorp, where it's a survey where you ask essentially four questions. The first question is, at what price would it be so low that you start to question the product's quality? The second question is, at what price do you think this product is starting to be a bargain? The third question is, at what price point do you think this product seems expensive? And the last one is, what price is this product, or at what point this has become too expensive? Then you plot the answers on a graph, and that gives you an approximation of what is the average price point that you should be going after. Ultimately, we often look at competitors, see how they price their products as well, because if you have a poorly differentiated product, chances are somebody may be trying out different sets of products, not only yours, or you know, if you raise prices too much, they may leave and go to a competitor if your product is not differentiated or sticky. So it's a combination of research, experience, competitive analysis, and sort of your gut feeling. Gut feeling actually goes a long way here as well.
Could I have your take on, if we talk about pricing based on volume, difference between tiered and metered plans? For example, at UserList, one of our most successful switches was from volume-based plans towards a single flexible plan that grew and scaled automatically, because switching between those tiers was so painful for both customers and our support team, because we knew like they grew by 5 headcount of their users and now we are like doubling their bill. Oh, that is definitely unfair. So for us, this smooth curve was much, much better. Our founder friend said that this looks like boiling a frog gradually. So right. That's what we're sort of doing, and that's fair both to customers and ourselves. What is your take? When is it better to have like tiers, and when it is better to have a scale?
Yeah, so with usage-based pricing, I mean, usage-based pricing is great, because with usage-based pricing, the more you pay. On the flip side, the less you use the product, the less you pay. But studies have shown that if you find a good proxy value metric, so a metric that basically you use within the product, such as number of seats or you know number of gigabytes or minutes for video, and if that ties to the value that the product is delivering, that usually gives you the most revenue. So in terms of tiering or usage-based pricing, so again, first of all, you have to identify what is that proxy value metric. So once you do that, then there's different ways of doing it. Amazon, for instance, when they get a bill from Amazon, it's different every month, because it really depends on you know how many virtual machines I run, how many gigabytes I use. So every month it's different. It's pure usage consumption. For companies that like Salesforce, they do seat-based pricing. And what they typically do is they'll negotiate with you up front and they'll say, hey, you know, how many seats do you think you'll need this year? And if you tell them 30, they'll give you sort of like a discounted price up front for 30. And, you know, every extra seat will be, you know, $50 onwards. Or you can buy just 10 up front, but then every extra seat will be $100. So that's sort of like their way of getting you into usage-based pricing with an upfront commitment. In terms of bill shock, I think it depends on the product. So like I said, in case of Amazon, you know, like people are used to this consumption model where every month your bill will be a little bit different, because it's like a telephone bill. It's like the more you use, you know, the more you pay. With other companies like Salesforce or, you know, like products where, again, like it's not considered to be a utility, then there's this price shock. And that's where you can sort of like get more into tactics like Salesforce, where you ask upfront, or you do discounts, or again, like once you hit a certain threshold, there's a trigger in the product where you actively have to get more. This just happened to me with Calendly yesterday. I had to add another member, and I had to go from one plan to the next, and I had to increase the number of seats. So that's also a good way to sort of like mitigate that shock of the bill you get at the end of the month.
Yeah, I'm glad you touched on those enterprise contracts, because for an outsider, it's a complete mystery how you can sell usage-based product for year upfront without really knowing how much they're going to use. And especially if certain implementation costs, like server costs, storage costs, are for the business, not just for them. So yeah, that's a great insight. Let's respond to one more question about raising prices, and
for sure.
Then we'll probably call it a day. So you mentioned that it's extremely important to anchor to value delivered when you're announcing your raise. We also wrote a blog post recently about pricing update emails. We have like 14 examples and teardowns. I'm going to link to that in the show notes. So what else should be in there, and what advice can you give when it comes to a pricing update?
I think one of the biggest considerations, we went through a couple of price increases with format. One of them is your billing frequency and billing systems. And what I mean by this is, if you have plans that are operating on annual basis, or if you sell annual plans, you have to keep in mind that the price increase will take over about a year to fully take effect, meaning that if somebody signed up last month and you're raising prices this month, they won't see the price increases till 11 months from now. So one of the big pieces of advice is, you have to really sort of get the reporting right, so you know who has already undergone a price increase and who hasn't. The monthly ones are typically easier because, again, like, you'll get through them in about a month. But again, like, the annual ones are the tricky ones. The other, on the operational side, you know, the other consideration is, are you going to be raising prices for everybody, or are there that you want to grandfather, meaning that you want to leave on old pricing? That's an important decision point, because there might be customers who basically might be what we call is what we used to call them sleepers. They signed up for the product, they haven't logged in, or they haven't actively used the product, but we think, again, like, they keep paying. So in case of Format, which is a website builder, you know, there's a chance that they still share their website, but there's a lack of insight about usage. So chances are, if you increase prices for that segment, it might be an opportunity for them to actually churn, which is something you want to avoid doing. So it might be a good idea to leave them on grandfather pricing until you have a chance to activate them or increase their usage. In which case, again, like, that becomes logistically even more challenging at times, because then you'll end up with customers on new pricing versus old pricing. So either you have, if you're lucky, you have a good system to manage all of this, all your subscription billing. If it's all homegrown, make sure you coordinate with the teams and invest in good reporting.
Yeah, it's not trivial when you start implementing a price change, because even letting them know in different ways can be challenging. Because if you have a tool that where users are segmented by their plan, then you can more or less automatically send those messages. Other than that, you're probably bound to, you know, your customer success folks sitting down and sending these out manually, which is not a pleasant thing to do, for sure.
I'm glad you mentioned customer success. So customer success plays a crucial role when it comes to raising prices, because ultimately they're the ones who are going to deal with the brunt of the frustrations. Nobody likes paying more. For the most part, you know, if you get this right, if you are consistently delivering value and there's an opportunity to raise price, and if you explain that you're investing in the product, you know, and you're doing this for the sake of building and delivering more features, then most customers understand it and they're fine with it. But those who don't usually are very vocal and frustrated, and the support team or the customer success team is the one that deals with it. So the best practice is to really work with them early on in the process and equip them with playbooks. And what I mean by playbooks is, you know, give them sort of canned responses and tools to deal with some of those frustrated customers. It could be in the form of discounts. So if somebody complains that, hey, this price is too high, I can't afford it, and I'm going to churn, you can give them ability to provide those customers with, you know, 20% off, 30% off, but you have to be specific about how much they can discount before, you know, asking for a special permission. So playbooks are key, and customer success and support are your sort of best partners when it comes to raising prices effectively.
As we're wrapping up today's episode, what is one do and one don't that you could share on the topic of monetization strategy for SaaS?
Yeah, so the first do is consider pricing and product monetization as an ongoing practice. You know, markets change, competition changes, your product changes, your customers change. So it's really, really important to reassess pricing and packaging and the way you sell your products on an ongoing basis. That's sort of like my number one advice. It's a process, not something you do once and, you know, leave it alone for years to come. I guess my second advice is don't be afraid to raise prices. As we talked a lot in this episode, it is very time consuming, but it's somewhat scary, but it can have super positive impact on your recurring revenue. And it has compounding impact as well. So again, like if you get that 20-30% extra in MRR this year, it will only compound next year and the following years. A lot of people are sort of apprehensive. It almost feels dirty to raise prices. But again, at the end of the day, as a product company, you're investing a lot in the products, in R&D. And prices that is really the revenue that you're collecting for the value that you're offering. So don't be afraid to raise prices.
Thanks so much for the awesome advice. Where can people find more of your work and your company online?
You can follow me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. I post a lot of tips and advice on product monetization. So you can connect with me or follow me. I'm John Kotowski, Kotowski. Or you can, if you'd like to find out more about what we do as Byerson and how we help other SaaS companies with product monetization, go to our website, which is byersoninc.com.
Well, thanks so much once again, and have a wonderful rest of your week.
Thank you, Jane.
Thanks for listening. You can find a written recap for this episode at useless.com/podcast. Please help us grow by leaving a review on iTunes.